This is the Meat Eater Podcast coming at you shirtless, severely bug-bitten, and in my case, underwearless.
We hunt the Meat Eater Podcast.
You can't predict anything.
Kurt Roscoe, dude, wrote in to say that you were harder than a woodpecker's... I want to say like a woodpecker's pecker, but that wasn't what he said. But it had a ring to it, but it was like harder than a woodpecker's beak. But I don't think that was it.
I guess that's a compliment.
Yeah, it is a comment. But he was referring more to the eating of your hot tip of just instead of putting boiling water into freeze-dry food envelopes, you just put regular water in there at noon in order that it'll be fully rehydrated by nighttime.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that makes one harder than a woodpecker's pecker, or whatever it was. Were you employing that strategy on your?
I did a couple of days. Yeah. But it got so cold. That was one thing I didn't, mention before. Is it got so cold that sometimes it just never rehydrates, or it was freezing. It was snowing, so that can create its own problems too.
So what were you doing then?
I brought more fuel. Surprisingly enough, after our conversations, I got to thinking about a couple of things. And I thought, you did on several things. The first thing is that I brought a pair of sunglasses.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. But they were a cheap pair and I lost them on the hike in, so they didn't do me much good.
Yeah. So some dude's loving it.
Yeah. Some guys I liked it, sweet. And then I stuffed them in my pocket. Next thing they're gone, and that's the way it goes.
See, I haven't brought, I didn't bring sunglasses, doll sheep hunting. I didn't bring them elk hunting. You talked me out of it.
And we wouldn't have used them on our sheep hunt. There was maybe a day. But, up there, too, I feel like the sun's so low. It's not like, at those higher latitudes, right, where you're not getting that, direct sun as much.
Yeah.
It just is like, you've seen that stuff where you're hunting at super high latitudes where, especially you get later in the year, where it just seems like it's dawn. And then sometime around 1 or 2 o'clock, nothing changes, but you just all of a sudden register it as evening.
Yeah.
Because the sun is at this super low, shallow angle, way off at the horizon. And it just is like dawn all day. And at some point, you just jump to thinking of it as evening, and it never feels like midday.
No. It's almost a flat light, it seems like. Almost like a cloudy day type of.
It's never that just... bearing down on you.
Yeah.
But you went out and tell us what happened. Cause we talked about the prelude. This is Kurt doing the impossible hunt.
Yeah. So,
explain the impossible. I like to call it the impossible hunt, though I've never done it.
Yeah. Well, and we've talked about it before. There are 5 districts in the state of Montana that are, they call them the unlimited sheep hunts, and they're unlimited in the sense that anybody can purchase a tag from anywhere and go. And each one of the units has a quota, typically right around 2 sheep, 2 legal rams, which in most cases ends up being, 5-year-old ram. It's a check the regs, but kind of a 4 5/8 or what would it say? Little under 3/4. And so from there, the season stays open for about 2.5 months all the way through regular rifle season as long as the quota stays open. And that's really kind of the nuts and bolts of it.
How many times have you tried to do it?
I've hunted it 4 years.
And killed one ram.
Killed one, yeah. Yeah, well, I should clarify. I will have hunted it 4 years by next year. So, yeah, I've hunted it 3 years so far.
Because if you get one, you have to take 7 years off.
You have to take 7 years off, yeah.
So you just finished your 7-year hiatus and went this year.
Yep, went this year.
You did see a single...
Hold on, I don't understand. No. This was your 4th season or not?
No, next year will be my 4th season.
Okay.
I thought you said, how many times are you going to hunt?
You did it once.
Yep.
You did the unlimited unit once.
Yep.
You saw sheep or didn't see sheep?
I didn't see sheep.
Okay, you did it once and didn't see it. You did it again, killed one.
Yep.
Waited 7 years.
Yep.
Did it, and we'll get to what happened.
Yeah.
Didn't see shit.
Nope.
And then next year you're going, who knows?
Yeah, who knows? Yeah, that'll be the fun part.
Didn't see a single one.
Nope, didn't see a single one.
Were you looking?
That's all you do.
You went into your secret special canyon.
Yeah, yeah.
Which you hunted before.
I did.
You didn't see any in.
I did. Well, I headed that direction. I made it 9 miles in when I hunted it the last time, and this time went a bit further and got to about 17 miles and kind of started working my way back from there. And yeah, that was just the program. You know, you get to a nice spot where you can glass and then spend as much of the day behind the spotting scope and binoculars as you can, just trying to pick out, you know, you're looking little rock slides, avalanche chutes, anywhere you think it's going to hold game, and just keep changing your angle. Try and find embedded during the day, and obviously the hot times are in the evenings and in the mornings. So
they're pretty crepuscular, like just like an elk or a mule deer. Like you're going to see them on their feet mostly early and late.
Yeah, I think typically. But the other thing I've found too is that I haven't found necessarily, especially elk, is that you'll see them get up and move around during the day at random times.
Like take a leak and shift around?
No, I've caught them feeding.
Okay.
You know, in the middle of the day or, you know, late mornings. Mm-hmm. You just never know. I think the key is just to be behind the glass and be ready for whenever they are moving.
What name for me the mammals that you saw that weigh over 2 pounds?
I saw grizzly bear, black bear, goats, a couple of mule deer on the way in, and that was it. It's pretty devoid of game.
No elk.
No elk, not even an elk track.
How many grizzlies?
Just one. Yeah.
Way off or up in your business?
No, he was just right across the canyon, right where I was glassing for sheep. Yeah, just rummaging around.
What was the black bear doing?
He was running away from me. Yeah, I jumped him in the timber coming back
did
out.
You?
Yeah.
No elk?
No elk.
And how many days did you spend glassing?
Six. I was in there six.
And then the unit shut down?
The unit shut down, yeah.
Have you talked to the guys that wound up getting them?
No, huh?
Have you heard any rumors?
You hear little rumors. I don't know exactly where they were. The first one happened pretty quick, and then the second one was a few days into the season.
And did you run into any other sheep hunters?
I did. Not where I was, but when I got back to about the 9 mile mark, I saw a couple more camps in that area. And then, you know, a few other camps on the way out.
Oh,
from
really?
There. Yeah. Yeah, so.
Did you talk to anybody?
I didn't. No, uh-uh. Nobody was around.
Horse camp?
There was one camp that was a horse camp. I was really surprised to see horses back in there. I hadn't seen them that far.
Because it's too rough a ground for horses.
Yeah. I'm no expert on horses, but it is just chunky, rocky, boulder, you know, lots of exposure in spots. I was surprised to see them there.
What was the longest period you sat sitting in one spot that you spent sitting in one spot without moving at all?
Probably 3 or 4 hours. Okay. And then I'd try to get up and at least change, you know, by a couple hundred yards. But the wind so my camp was up over 11,000 feet, and you'd have to find spots that are secluded or hidden behind rocks to just because the wind, it just relentless.
Freezing, you know, your butt.
Well, it's cold and you can't keep your glass still.
Oh, that kind of wind.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, 30, 40 mile an hour wind coming across some of those plateaus during the day. So
that eats away at your soul after a while.
Dude. It does.
Dude, it starts to make you feel like you're going a little bit insane, man.
Yeah. It can.
The wind does to me.
It does. Yeah. So, you know, but being able to tuck off of one edge and get into some, you know, larger boulders, there's a lot of structure in there. So if you can find a nice spot, but it all just depended on wind direction and, you know, where you were. But I had, I have several other friends that were hunting the district. So including me, there was, you know, four other groups of good buddies that I talked to after they got out. And between our four groups, you know, one group saw two sheep. And so it was one of those years. You know, they're there, they're not.
So do you feel that they were in your, did you just hunt one canyon?
No, I hunted, I had a plan where I just sequentially worked through the different canyons. And it really depended on the time of day too, because there's some stuff you can't glass in the morning that it'd be better to glass in the evening, or the sun comes up, you get the glare, you just can't pick it apart like you need to, or the wind. You know, it's hard to be on one side of the mountain when you're getting this constant wind coming through in the morning.
Were you seeing nice beds and nice sheep shit and everything?
No, there isn't a lot up, and that's kind of the difference. Is I was glassing from a spot that really isn't going to hold sheep. You know, you're
where you're sitting isn't going to hold sheep.
Yeah,
yeah, you're looking where the camping beds would be, but you're
that's
not.
It. Yeah, trying to find good vantage.
You should have been with us, man. We saw a dandy.
Yeah,
real dandy. Different state.
Yeah, if you have a permit in Southeast Washington.
Yeah, a lot of beds, a lot of tracks, and then one nice big ram.
So is the fact that you're calling this the impossible hunt because it's an unlimited hunt, everyone's going and they're chasing them, and there's just
success rates are like abysmal.
Yeah.
For example, the unit that I hunted this year, they didn't ever take a ram out of last year.
Wow.
Yeah, and 2.5 month season. Yeah.
This isn't the units where they're trying to wipe them out.
No. That was a little bit different. That was a very unique situation down in the Tendoys here.
Yeah,
and that was like a pneumonia thing.
Yeah, that they decided to turn over and ask the hunters to help with the management of it.
Mm-hmm. Can you? I have 17 bighorn points. Can I do the unlimited hunt without using my 17 points?
That's a really good question. I'm not sure.
I believe you can.
Because, man, I want to go.
I know at some point you'd lose them, though, so I don't know if you could put in or if you could. That'd be something you'd have to check in the regs.
What I needed to happen is you to get one and then you to want to go and just mess around during your seven-year period.
For the next 7 years.
And I would go with you after I draw my regular one.
See, that's probably a good plan.
So there's a lot of steps that need to fall into place here, but I'm kind of curious about it, man.
Yeah.
Okay, so not a single elk.
A lot of wind.
Were you regretting or were you liking it?
Oh, no, huh? It was perfect. It was a great hunt. Yeah, the only thing is it just wasn't long enough.
And it snowed on you.
Yeah, snowed on me one day. In my position, one of the things that's really important is getting good days of field to test new products. So that was a big part of being able to do that. And those type of conditions are very conducive to doing that.
To see the limits of stuff.
Yeah, see the limits of stuff and see how they truly perform. Because it's one thing to go out and wear something for a hike. It's a totally different thing to live in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
What kind of stuff are you testing?
We have...
Like future things?
Yeah. We have quite a bit of stuff coming out here in January, so...
Yeah, you can get all tight-lipped now, right?
Yeah, there's some of it that,
just
that
give me
I'm
like,
not...
Like a, just give me like a, you know, like a... Like a
whatever you can.
Well, like a tip. I'll just say I was very warm at night in my sleeping bag. So,
is that right?
Yeah. We have a couple coming out in that line. So,
really,
yeah.
Side zip or center zip?
Side.
Classic.
Yep. Vent. Then you can vent.
Yanni's been running like the old schoolinest hoodless sleeping bag for warm weather.
Yeah.
I didn't know they made those anymore.
I didn't either.
Well, it's a special, Nemo makes it. It's, I think it's called their Argali Tensor combination, but it's meant to be like a warm weather backcountry hunter's setup where no hood to lighten it up, no bottom insulation to lighten it up. Your sleeping pack slides in there to act as your bottom insulation. So, I mean, the whole rig is, I mean, the bag compresses down to like this. I think it's right at a pound. It's a 15-degreer. You know, the pad is a pound, so your whole kit's at 2 pounds. And it's even got like a waterproof sort of barrier over the bottom 2 feet. So if your feet are sticking out from underneath your shelter, you know, if you're just running a tent or something, you know, so that it's pretty good. But yeah, as it gets colder, you miss that hood.
Say you guys did make a sleeping bag, just say.
Just say.
Would you just come out with like a single 15, or would you come out with a zero, a 15?
I think if we were going to do it, we'd probably come out with two.
Would it wind up being like a negative and a 15? Or
would it would probably end up being in that 15 and then a zero range. Yeah,
that's probably
a lot of hypotheticals.
Those are the only two you need, I feel like.
After, and they'd be conservative at that, at that
and
rating.
Then these would probably be filled with parts from a bird or parts
likely,
from an oil field.
Very, very likely from a
parts
bird.
From a bird.
Yeah,
woodpecker beaks,
water repellent birds.
I was going to ask. Yeah. Oh.
After 22 decades, I think, of sleeping in bags,
You slept in bags for 22 decades.
Sorry. Two. Is that what I meant?
It's like, you're like from the Old Testament.
I was trying to say.
You're from the Old Testament when people would live to be 600 years old.
I was trying to say 20 years, and then somehow as I was saying it, it turned into decades.
You switched.
But I've had a negative 20, and I've had bags I think as warm as 40 or 45. Mm-hmm. And just like those fringes, sure. If you got all the money in the world and you just want to have every bag for the specific situation, sure, have them. But for me and what I do and how I hunt, a 15 and a 0 gets it done.
I'm a 4. I like 4 because I got a way ass negative,
mm-hmm.
which is nice at times. I don't use it that much, but I have a way ass negative Nemo bag down. Then I like to have. But you understand, like, the peculiarities of my life, man. We're like, I get a lot of gear. This isn't like I'm going down to the store and buying all these things.
No, I know. I was trying to present it when I was saying
from a normal,
average Joe.
Okay. Then I'm going to present the average Joe. So scrap the one because you can combo your bags anyways. You can take two bags and combo them. So scrap. I would never go buy the mega negative. I would have a 0, a 15, and then this isn't like breaking the bank because when I'm up at my fish shack and stuff and it's super warm, but you got to bring a sleeping bag, I like just a summer weight bag. But they don't charge any money for those anyways.
Right.
See, I don't even think you need that.
It's a thin, synthetic summer weight bag.
I feel like you can just rock your 15 or 20 degree bag, but open. I use that in the summer. Yeah. That's okay.
That's what you use?
Run it like a blanket. I've done that.
Yeah.
So meanwhile, while you were out there, were you hunting whitetails at the same time?
When was he hunting?
I was in, the 7th. No, I went in the 10th.
Okay. So that's when I 11th. Ended my hunt.
Yeah.
I hunted from the 1st through the 10th.
Okay. No snow.
I was down way down the valley, the other side of the state.
Yeah. It's funny that these two things, that Mark Kenyon's deal and your deal would be in the same state. Because you're like hunting bighorns at
11,000 feet.
11,000 feet. And Mark's out in the Badlands.
Ish.
Badland-ish.
Yeah.
That sort of appearance.
Yeah. It's hot and low. Chasing whitetails.
And what was going on? What was your deal?
Well, I was hunting Montana first. And then if I could fill my Montana tag, I was going to go over to North Dakota and try to fill a tag over there.
So you just got like little spots.
Little spots, public land.
How many states do you have little whitetail spots in?
Oh, geez. 5, 6, 7, something like that. I mean, I usually hunt like Michigan, Ohio, and either Indiana or Illinois or Nebraska or Iowa, one of those states. Like usually those three states, like every year, some cycle there. And then I've been adding in like a western state every year. And like then
a new western one.
Mm-hmm. But I've love Montana, so I've been hitting that the last 3 years.
Do you ever go out and hunt whitetails in Wyoming?
No, but I want to. I've looked at it. I have some ideas of where to go.
You don't hunt any public land in Michigan, do you?
No, I do.
You do? Southern Michigan?
Southern and northern. Yeah. I've got some southern land stuff that I hit like on days when the conditions aren't great to go into my really good areas that, you know, I'm trying to wait for the right times to hit that stuff, but I still want to hunt. There's a couple pieces of public land that I kind of dive in and try like aggressive tactics that I wouldn't normally try.
What kind of public land?
I'm even what
designation by who?
Yeah, like county stuff.
Okay.
We
used to hunt some public land in Michigan that wasn't even really that public. It was like it was a property owned by a township.
Yeah.
So nothing you're looking at is ever going to say like, "Hey, go here."
If you just got to know,
there's no like, if you go to a state website and they're like, "Here's places to hunt," it's not going to name.
Yeah.
It was a township where someone had at one point, I don't understand how this worked. Someone had at one point in time came in and they like surveyed the whole thing. We're going to break it up into lots. And this is on a lake. They're going to break it up into lots. I don't know how it happened, but it fell back into the township's hands. And we hunted waterfowl on it, trapped snap turtles on it, shot a lot of ducks off it. There were deer on it, hunted squirrels on it. Public land, but kind of like no one. Locals treated it publicly, but it was not like a destination public land.
Onyx, opening up everyone's eyes to that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, but it doesn't interpret it for you, though. Mm. You might look and be like, that's township. We went down and asked the township, like the township had a commissioner. And we went down there and said, what is up with this? And he kind of said, I can't tell you not to go on it. I can't tell you to go on it, but I can't really tell you not to go on it. And we took that to be, go ahead.
Yeah.
We took that to be the welcome invite.
Yeah, yeah. That's reasonable.
So you you chase them on county land.
And some state land up north. We've got my little family deer camp, it's a little 40-acre piece, but it's surrounded by state forest. So I grew up hunting that state forest, just roaming around the swamps, and that was this huge wilderness to me as a kid.
But you haven't gotten at Michigan yet this year?
No, it hasn't opened up yet.
October 1st.
Yep.
They still run the October 1st opener?
They do. That's just a few days away. I'm excited. Been looking at cameras.
So you're heading out there now?
Yeah. After this, I'm going to get in the truck and drive 24 hours back home. And 3 days from now or 4 days from now, get after those whitetails and home.
And what happened? I know how your Montana deal went down, but explain the whole, like, what your situation was.
Yeah. So this was a piece of public land, the east side of Montana. Basically what I look for when I'm finding these spots is public land that is either adjacent to or intersects with a river corridor. So looking for those riparian areas where there's that great cover and food that these whitetails need in these arid areas. And what's kind of cool about Western whitetail hunting versus at home is at home, the whitetail habitat is spread out over everywhere. And these deer are all over the place. In Montana or Wyoming or Colorado or the Dakotas, it's kind of crammed down into these smaller corridors. So
Isn't that amazing? I noticed that in my house. I mean, there's like a distinct line where it's like below that line, that's where the whitetails live, and above that line is where the mule deers live.
When I'm sitting in my new house, we got whitetails zigzagging across our yard. And last night, we with the spot and scope, we glassed up two like impressive mule deer bucks up above our house.
Nice. You got anyone whitetail hunting in your backyard yet?
It wouldn't go over. I about saw our car about hunting one this morning. Yeah. Oh, man. Our car tagged out.
Yeah, it'll happen. So over the years, I've found a handful of different little spots like this. And this is a spot that I'd gone and scouted and shed hunted this spring, looked it over real good, found a lot of antlers, liked the looks of it. And it kind
of. When you're out there, are you seeing other tree stands, other trail cams?
No, not at all. It was very different than back home. And again, I think it's because
people here don't care about whitetails.
It's Mark's untouched whitetail paradise. Yeah, it's like Eastern Montana.
Do you ever feel like weird?
Pig and mud.
Yeah.
It's great because everyone thinks these are little like rats running around their farms, and I'm just the happiest kid in the candy store.
Yeah, I've heard them called that. They call them like field rats or prairie rats or something like that.
So I've never seen another tree stand. In North Dakota, I saw tree stands. But
Run into dudes who are like, hey, what are you doing? What are you after?
I do.
And they express surprise.
Yeah. Oh, really? Whitetails? There's elk up there. I'm like, oh, no.
You got it all wrong, sonny.
3 years ago, I bumped into two guys whitetail hunting the same section I was hunting. They were just walking around it with their bows. And then they saw me in a tree, and like, hey. And they turned.
They were just out belly crawling on them?
They weren't to that point yet, but they were upright.
You don't do that much.
I haven't, but more people are testing the waters with that, and it's intriguing to me. I've been seeing more folks chase whitetails on the ground and showing that, you know, it's certainly possible with a bow.
Yeah.
So it's something that I'm thinking about experimenting a little bit more with. Been trying a lot of new things. I'm going to be doing a bunch of new things this year as far as that kind of stuff, using some different gear to get in the tree. We can talk about that later, but instead of tree stands, I've been shifting to a tree saddle.
Yeah.
Which has been something really interesting that helps a lot with the public land kind of stuff I do. So
you came out and shed hunted this spot.
Yeah.
As a scouting measure.
Yep. Walked it, found antlers, you know, confirmed what I thought from maps and from previous times kind of walking around the area. And what I really like to find is, like I said, this public land that's intersects with that riparian area. But if it's particularly hard to get to in one way or another, that's of course something that is a benefit to any public land hunter, right? You guys talk about that with elk and mule deer. Same thing with whitetails. It's just that the bar for being hard to get to is much lower for whitetail hunters. So a mile and a half walk is like most whitetail guys just won't do that. Not saying that they won't, but just typically doesn't happen.
Yeah, and it winds up being like, because in that type of hunting too, you have a lot of guys that are going out after work, going out in the morning. You just kind of want to get up and right?
Yeah, it's not like a week-long expedition style hunting.
It could be counterproductive because it's like
they don't care.
Yeah, the whitetails aren't necessarily living 5 miles away from
They hide
where you
plain sight.
Yeah.
Park your car.
So the two spots that I in particular was interested in getting after on this trip, one of them, you had a piece of public land that was from the road to a river. And then that piece of public land that was not very productive. It was grazed over, no cover. Didn't seem that the deer used it much except for
grazed over by cattle.
Yeah. And sheep. I didn't think that deer were using it except for not bighorns. These are like the Bah sheep.
true field rats.
Yes, the true field rats. And they weren't using this area in daylight. Maybe crossing it at night, but it wasn't going to be a spot I'd want to hunt. But there was a piece of landlocked public land back behind some private land that you could get to if you walked that river. So we talked about this the other day, but the basic gist of this situation was I'd assumed that with the stream access laws in Montana, you could walk that river to get in that private land, or sorry, to get past the private land and hunt the public land. After talking to some people, hearing some different ideas on this, it sounds like there are some gray areas around that, whether or not I can legally use the public waterway to get to the public land. So I had gotten permission from this private landowner whose land was around the public in the spring to shed hunt it and scout it and everything. Coming into the hunting season, I called him again a week ahead of time just to confirm, hey, is it still okay that I walk the river to get to this public land that's tucked behind yours? He expressed, you know, that no, not now, not now.
And you're not saying I want to hunt your place. You're saying to him, I'm not hunting your place. I'm passing through.
Exactly. And I'm not even going to be on your ground. I'm literally going to walk I'm going to walk in the river. I'm going to wade the river below the banks. No deer are going to hear me, see me, smell me. I'm not going to mess up anyone else's hunting. I'm just going to walk the river, step up into the public land.
Any beaver sign in that river?
You know, not much, surprisingly.
Any mink tracks?
Nope. Didn't see anything like that.
You ever kill whitetail deer, Kurt?
Yeah, I have. Yeah, when I living over in the western part of the state, you know, I grew up.
Yeah. Well, have you done that out there?
On the western side of the state?
Yeah.
Dude, that's but white I want tail to. Central, man. We go up by my sister-in-law's place. It's like nasty thick. But people rattle in big giants over there.
Well, my trip next
year. That's
what
we need to go do.
I want to next year do a backpacking whitetail hunt in like northwestern Montana or northern Idaho. Backpack into some of that stuff and chase whitetail.
So happily going. I know some.
Let's do it.
I got some hot tips, hot leads.
I think that would be really cool.
Okay, so go on. No beaver sign.
Yeah, no beaver
sign.
Kirk
got a whitetail.
Kirk got a whitetail. I got permission in the spring, but in the fall when I called back, it was like, probably not. I've got family that's going to be hunting his property. So that kind of threw me for a tailspin. Hunt whitetails, yes. They have a grandson or son-in-law or something like that who does like to hunt whitetails. And what's
is he a Wired to Hunt fan?
I don't know. I didn't go that far. But what's cool? What makes this piece of public great? I already mentioned the first thing, the riparian area. Number two, it's hard to get to because to get to it, you have to do this long hike down the first piece. Then you have to take half mile down this river. The third thing that's great about it is that on the private land is food, the best food source all around. These big alfalfa fields. So you've got
irrigated alfalfa fields.
So tons of deer coming in to feed on that private land. And this public land is really nicely tucked right behind that, basically.
And they're bedding up in what?
They're bedding in like Russian olive bushes and some intermittent cottonwood groves.
You know, have you seen this down there? Because I've seen this in that part of the state where they're actually going up into the canyons quite a ways to bed.
See, I didn't see that in this area, but I was pretty far from the canyon walls. Like the area I was hunting, it was wide enough at that point.
You know those areas where the sandstone bluffs come down and actually form like classic like rock wall? Yeah, because we've been in hunting mule deer and have sat at night and watched whitetails come out of the juniper and ponderosa. And there's these little like canyons that have got the bottoms got green ash in them and come out at night and just do these long treks down into hit that riparian stuff and then come up through the sagebrush and shit and filter up into these little canyons to go to bed at night.
They're incredibly adaptable animals. It is amazing the different types of areas they can make work. In this area, there was so much concentrated cover right there along the river that they were just packed in there. So this public was kind of really nicely settled right behind the food, kind of in the midst of the bedding, but a bit of a transition from the best bedding to the food. So long story short on all this is that I ended up being worried that I wasn't going to have any more permission. So I was looking at the maps, trying to find a few other spots. But when I showed up, went and talked to the landowner, had a really nice conversation with him and his wife. And they said, you know, it's okay. Our family isn't going to be now here for another week or two.
Were you greasing some palms?
No, I was just no grease and palms, just having a nice friendly chat. And
just a nice boy, nice wholesome boy.
Nice wholesome boy.
Show pictures of your baby.
Yeah, I did.
Oh, come on, man. Really? You got manipulative?
No, it just came up in conversation. I'm not going to hold that back. He really just wants his daddy to come back with a deer.
Yeah, he's just home starving. Doctor says you can't eat anything but deer meat.
I don't know how I did it, but some way or another, I did get permission. And I was really excited about that because I had all those things going for it.
And then you didn't have to be looking over your shoulder like we're talking
about.
Yeah,
you don't want to do that. I didn't want to do anything.
No, gray means when I was a younger man, gray meant go. Now gray means, man, I don't know.
Yeah, it's not.
I just hate that feeling.
Not worth it.
I hate the feeling.
Yeah, I 100% agree. So it was great to get that green light. Feel really good about that. So I was just camped off the road in my truck, sleeping in the back of my truck, camping there, and then every day would go and hunt these deer. And the fourth thing that was so good about this area was that that river allowed you almost perfect access and exit without notifying deer that there was a human hunter in there at all. Because yep. I could get into that river. I was like 4 feet below the
high banks.
Mm-hmm. So I would walk that riverbed leaving no scent because I'm in the water almost the whole time.
Yep. Bloodhounds couldn't even find you.
Yeah, I don't want that. and then basically I'm able to hop right up on shore, get up in a tree.
So you're wearing chest waders?
Hip waders. I was stupid. I bought like $15 packable waders.
Did you buy Wiggies?
No, they're Hodgman's.
That's where you went wrong, man.
Yeah, I guess so.
Gotta buy Wiggies Glacier socks.
I don't know. For that long of a hike, I don't know if they would have.
Yeah, but you put them in your pocket. You know what those are.
Oh, yeah, I got them.
You got one.
The ones without the feet, the one for the plastic boots, but I've also seen.
Oh, because then, probably lets them last a long time.
Yeah, they last for a long time.
What we're talking about is, have we covered this before?
We must have talked about it in our dull sheep hunt recap, but.
Yeah, explain them.
It's basically just, it looks like an oversized, sock that comes all the way up to your crotch, almost, and it's just got at the top end of it. It's got a little clip that goes around your belt, and the bottom has just a very thin, rudimentary sort of sole. But they're big and baggy enough that you can just slip them right over your boots. So every time you get to a stream crossing, you just pull them out of your pack. We were crossing the stream so much, we would just hang them off our shoulder strap. We'd get there, throw them on. Take 5 or 10 steps to get across the stream and then, you know, take them off and put them back on.
Yeah, and they roll up like way smaller than a Nerf football.
Yeah. They're probably a pound and a half.
What's the fabric or what's it made of?
It's a 70D nylon, I think. There's a couple of, sometimes they use a 210 nylon. Some of them are a 70D. Depends on which ones you get. And then, I believe they use it's a full urethane coating is what they create the.
So it's reasonably strong.
Yeah.
Stuff.
Yes.
Yeah.
You wouldn't want to bushwhack through a bunch of beaver chewed sticks with them. That's for sure.
No, the guy that we bought them from said if you just leave them on and just start and hike up the stream bed, crossing the stream, and then hike on dry rocks for a while, you're gonna put holes in them quick.
So I got something kind of like that, but it must be the much less quality version of that. It was $15 on Amazon. Basically, it was like an oversized garbage bag that I slid up both my legs.
I've done that too, contractor bags.
Well, yeah, kind of essentially that's what it was.
You can get a lot of miles out of crossing creeks on contractor bags.
Probably more than I got out of these.
It was that deep though, huh? You needed it up to your hips.
Yeah, their spots were up to your hips, and I ripped it the very first crossing. I ripped a big old hole in it. So then the rest of that night, I had to just wade through it and filling it with water. I was like, well, okay. So I got soaked that first night. Had to drive an hour and a half to the nearest town the next day. Bought hip waders.
Oh, then you bought hip waders.
Yeah, good hip waders, like those irrigator ones. You know,
yeah, I'm with you. Okay, so you climb out a creek, no smell.
Yep.
All nice and dry.
All nice and dry.
No beaver sign.
Mm-hmm. And
slip up into your
spot.
Are you carrying a tree stand around on your back?
Yeah. So that's usually I've got a tree stand and climbing sticks that I bring with me, which are basically like a big metal stick that's got three steps on it. You strap that to the tree, climb up, strap another one to the tree, climb up. But this year, like I said, instead of the tree stand, I've got this saddle, which is kind of like a rock climber's harness or like a arborist harness.
Yeah.
And then so I attach these sticks to the tree so I can climb up to 15, 20 feet or whatever. And then I attach a rope with a Prusik knot on the end of it that basically allows me to adjust the height of this clip.
Suicide Prusik or double Prusik?
I don't know. It's pretty
tight. Two wraps on top and two wraps on bottom?
I don't know. Pre-tied. I didn't pay too much attention.
Oh, it's pre-tied. I got you.
Yeah, it was all part
of
it.
We had a big conversation about this the other day. When I used to do arborist work, like when you tie a Prusik, if you look at it, it's got like four wraps, two wraps above and two wraps below. When I used to do like tree climbing work, you would just do two below and one above, and you could control it with your thumb. Like the slightest amount of thumb pressure would open the knot, and you like fast. Like you're supposed to do two wraps, then you got to like forcibly pull the rope through the knot. But the guy I worked for would call it a suicide knot. He didn't like it, but it was just really nice because just like a little flick of your thumb, that knot would open up, and you know.
This would have been definitely been two on top, two on bottom.
I'm only bringing this up because we were just discussing this. Because the same knot is great for tightening tent guy lines.
Yeah, I can see that.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah,
so basically you've got you just clip into this thing, and then your knees are up against the tree, and then you're just kind of hanging, sitting.
God, you're not just like legs falling asleep and stuff up there?
No, you've got a platform that your feet can set on. So there's a couple different options people do. Some people just have their climbing stick pegs there at the foot level, or they'll put in a handful of other steps around the tree, or you can attach a small platform. So what I was using is you're basically a tree stand, a cast aluminum, I think, tree stand type platform, but a tiny miniature version of that. So instead of like a 30-inch long tree stand platform, this is like 8 inches by 10 inches, this little tiny thing that you can attach to the tree that just gives you somewhere to keep your feet and then gives you like a pivot point to allow you then to pivot in different directions around the tree. So I could shoot almost 360 degrees anywhere around this tree, spinning around, leaning left, leaning right, all the time.
You had to practice a lot out of this thing, huh?
I did practice a little bit, yeah. But it was much more intuitive and comfortable than I had even expected. And so instead of going in there with, you know, let's say a 10 or 12 pound pack of sticks and then a 12 pound or 13 pound tree stand plus my camera gear plus my backpack plus my bow, rangefinder, all that other stuff. Instead of that, I'm able to cut like 13 pounds right off the gate without carrying that tree stand in. So it's much lighter weight hiking in, much less work getting set up in the tree, and comfortable. And so that first night was the first time I'd ever hunted in it, was that first night of the season in Montana. And snuck in there, got up into a tree, and was in this spot where I thought, based off what I'd seen in the past, you know, walking around, seeing this area, these deer were going to transition from that Russian olive type brush where they're bedded through this small little open cottonwoody grove towards the private land where that food was behind me. And that's what happened, basically. I was, you know, while I was getting set up in the tree, I had two small year and a half old bucks come by, and then over the course of the night, just deer after deer after deer.
Flooding out of there.
Mm-hmm.
Squirrels like that Russian olive.
Yeah.
Like, well, to eat it.
I believe it.
Did you see fox squirrels in there?
Yeah. I saw a little bit of, I'm sure I saw squirrels. I don't know if I paid enough attention to say what they were, but
if you saw, correct that.
I'm not a squirrel guy.
No, like, yeah, I'm not a skunk guy, but if I see a skunk, I'm like, I register it.
There were so many whitetails in there.
You weren't registering squirrels.
No.
You know, it's a non-native plant. It's a real deleterious plant.
I have heard about that. It was brought in like the Depression era, wasn't it?
It's fast growing.
Mm-hmm.
You can make windrows out of it in a hurry.
I think that was what.
But it's, you know, it's displacing native trees.
Yeah.
And it's just.
Yeah, it's like it's all over the place out there on the riparian quarter.
I love it. Squirrels like it.
But the deer love it too. And I saw a lot of deer, and eventually at one, almost in the same couple minutes, a mature buck, group of five bucks came by on one side of me, including one mature buck that I would have tried to take, and then behind me another mature buck, both of them about 80 yards on either side of me.
And no one out there hunting?
Nobody else out there hunting. It was my little playground. which is
cool. And they look all summery.
Yeah, because, I mean, most of them are still in velvet, still have their summer coat, kind of orangey coat. Beautiful. I mean, it's neat to be out there in the woods at that point when you're seeing deer.
Makes like their that. Antlers look big.
Makes their antlers look really big. Because
their necks are thin. They don't have any puffy hair. Yeah. It looks strange. Their faces look kind of emaciated.
Yeah.
And I know they're fat and happy.
And that time of year is so fun because these deer are on such a consistent pattern. You know, they're going to bed and go to feed. They're going to bed and they're going to go to feed. That's basically all they do.
Because they're not playing grab ass.
They're not playing grab ass. They are very comfortable because they haven't been hunted yet. It's the very beginning of the season. So you can really see these deer acting very naturally, going about their everyday life. And that's just fun from a deer enthusiast. Like, I just love watching these critters, getting to be in that kind of situation and seeing deer do deer things, you know, rather than back home in Michigan. And by the time you get to late October, these are deer that feel like they're in the middle of a war zone, that are hardly moving in daylight at all. And you're not going to see mature bucks hardly at all or anything like that. They're all nocturnal. Out here, I'm seeing 4- and 5- and 6-year-old bucks happily hanging out, playing with each other, sparring, doing different things. That's just neat. So I was enjoying it from that perspective.
You're painting a compelling picture.
It's not that great. You should not come out and hunt Montana for whitetails.
All that said, it sucks. So it's pretty bad.
But yeah, the basic gist of that first night was that I saw a couple nice bucks that I would have gotten a shot at if I could have been close enough, but they were out of range. So I snuck out that night after everything had passed through. And had a game plan for the next day. And the issue, though, was that the next day I had a wind direction that would have been blowing into that bedding area. Mm-hmm. And I knew, like, this spot's so good. If I go, I want to go back in there right away, right? I'd seen all these bucks. I knew if I moved I moved where I was hunting, like 60 yards farther north to where most of those deer came by, I thought I'd be able to get a shot. I was pretty confident the
and
deer
still have the wind be good.
Mm-hmm. Well, if the wind was good, I could move 60 yards up there. But wind wasn't good.
That takes restraint, man. It takes restraint to bag it because the wind's bad.
Yeah. And it was tough. Like, I so badly wanted to go back in there. I'd seen so many deer. I was like, this is such a honey hole. But I just knew if you wait till the conditions are right, you will kill a deer there. If you go back in there tomorrow and just hope to get lucky, you're gonna mess it up. So I said, nope, I'm not going to go to that honey hole. There was one other piece of public I'd seen on the maps that looked pretty good that I hadn't been to ever before. I thought, well, I'm going to give this other spot a rest, wait till the wind's right. I'm going to go check out this new spot. And this new spot kind of had all the same things going for it that night number one spot did. It was along the riparian corridor. It was hard to get to, and it was tucked behind private land that had food on it. But what made this one hard to get to versus the first was that rather than walking a river, I had to walk more than a mile up on top of this big bluff and then go down one of those steep, nasty canyons like you were talking about, like basically sliding down this canyon. I had to bring tent poles because I didn't have trekking sticks or anything. So I
tent
had
poles?
Like a tarp pole.
Yeah.
So it was not ideal, but it was all I had. And I was like, well, I need something to give me some kind of support as I'm sliding down this. So got down in this canyon.
But not so bad that you needed to rappel in.
Not so bad at a rappelling. But
that'd have been sweet.
That's next year. But got down in this canyon, got in this little piece of public land again, and same kind of deal. There were deer bedded back in this public Russian olive cottonwood brush. They would transition through this little piece of public out towards that private land with the alfalfa. But again, wasn't right close enough. So I did see another mature buck that I would have shot at if I could have, but he was about 120 yards away. Bunch of does, some little bucks. Not quite as much action as the first night, but again, I felt good. Like, I've got a
nice
second
spot.
I've got a
like
second
a big
spot.
Huge giant buck.
Not a big huge giant.
Bigger than the one you got.
I'd say similar.
Okay.
Ish. In that, like, definitely, you know, 3, 4, 5 year old somewhere in that. He was probably 4 or 5 years old, and he was a 10-pointer, kind of tight and tall, like 130s. Somewhere around there, maybe 140 if we care about score
so
at all.
You're like, wow,
that's a nice buck.
There's a buck.
Yeah, I mean, it was a buck. I was like, ooh, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's cool to see that. Too far away. So then I waited till they all went through, waited till after dark, till everything had transitioned off to those private fields, snuck out of there again. Now I know I've got two different spots I can work with. So depending on wind direction, whatever other conditions might change, I can adjust now.
You hunting by yourself?
Yep. Yep.
Just car camping by yourself.
Just car camping, sleep in the bed of the truck, make a little hot dog on the grill at night, drink a beer, pass out.
Don't you wish you had a story like this, Kurt?
That sounds nice.
And there's this one ram, and it's coming, and it's all these rams.
just have a beer.
Come buy me and
hot dogs.
Hot dogs.
Some more Rams. And
yeah.
It's a different
much kind of different
situation.
Couldn't decide which Ram I wanted to go after.
Yep.
We could go on for a while with the juxtapositions here.
Oh, yeah. Same state. Yeah. Very, very different experiences.
So then what happened?
So next day, the wind was right for the first area. So now I'm going back to the honey hole.
Honey hole number one. Mm-hmm.
Going back to honey hole number one, and I now have learned something since the first night. I know that the majority of these deer weren't traveling through the middle of this kind of transition. The majority of them were working this edge along the northern spot. So I snuck back in there this time with the better waders because I had to go to town and get the good waders and knowing that I want to go set up in a new tree. Snuck in there, got in there pretty early.
Hanging your tree in a cotton, hanging your sling in a cottonwood?
Yep, cottonwood. And got set up, same kind of deal as the first night. It's very, these deer were moving pretty early in the day. They were very comfortable.
Dude, yeah, the video you have of you shooting the buck you shot, looks like 100 degrees out, middle of the damn day.
Yeah, so I'm not going to talk, that's day four, we're still on day three. But
I'm just jumping ahead.
But yeah, each day was warm.
It looks like daytime.
Yep, all this activity was happening, daytime, pretty warm. And again, it comes down to these were comfortable, not very hunted deer.
Yeah.
And I was kind of secretly able to get pretty far back in like their movement pattern, right? So these deer were moving past me relatively early in the day because they still had another couple hundred yards to get to the wide open field where they're going to feed. So most of my, it was getting dark, like 8:30 or something like that, maybe, or 8:50 at night. It was getting dark. And these deer were coming, the majority of the action I was seeing was between like 5:45 and 6:45. So several hours before dark, they were passing by me and then making their way out to these fields. So that night, got in there, here come the deer, started seeing some young bucks, some does. But I was a little worried because the first group of deer I was seeing, they actually cut in, they were heading right towards me, but then about 60 yards before they got to where I was going to be, they cut into this Russian olive stuff and kind of skirted inside away from me, just out of range in this thick stuff. And I'm thinking in my head, I'm like, gosh, is that what those deer did the night before? And my memory was just wrong. Did I set up 30 yards away from like the perfect spot? And I'm going to have another night here frustrated seeing all these deer go just out of range. So for the first like half hour, sitting there kicking myself and thinking, should I just pull everything down and move 30 yards? But there's already deer moving all over the place. Decided to stick it out. And glad I did, because around 6:15 or something along those lines, I'm looking over my left shoulder trying to see if there's anything behind me. And when I turn back, there's a big giant buck at 15 yards right in front of me in my main shooting lane right there.
Fall asleep?
No. I was looking this way and then turn around. He's there.
Looking at you?
No. Just kind of waltzing through. And this is like full velvet, big, like a tall tine, kind of curling in, great big giant 10-pointer. Beautiful deer. And it was that situation, like, instantly knew, oh yeah, that's a buck I'd like to get a shot at. The issue was that, you know, what he must have done is he must have come out of that Russian olive and there was one big bush in front of me at about 20 yards. And if that deer came from the left or right of that tree, of that bush, I would have seen him. But if he came in on that direct line, yeah, where the bush was in between, would never know till he was right there. That must be what happened. So I see him there. Two other nice bucks come behind him. So it's a bachelor group of these three bucks. He's right there. Like, he'd be the ideal shot. Like, when I planned this all out, when I sat in that tree, I was like, this is where I want to get a shot at. Well, that's where he was right now. But he was there before I was holding my bow, before anything. So I see him, register, okay, that's a buck I want to get a shot at. And at the same time, I try to grab my bow, spin into position, and turn my camera on and swing the camera around to get film of him.
Wired on.
Yeah, wired on. And of course, I was not able to do that fast enough before he got behind some branches and I couldn't get a shot. I was like trying to weasel my way. Can I spin around a little more and like slip it through some of these branches? But I knew that I wasn't going to risk some kind of wonky shot. He didn't spook. He walked right in and was just kind of like, I think if I remember right, he started coming like straight at me. These other two bucks with him did come directly to my tree stand or my tree, my steps, and were like sniffing around underneath there. And eventually one of them caught wind of something that they didn't quite like. And one of them bolted. They didn't blow. They didn't really freak out. But the one bolted And that caused the other two to kind of bounce off. And they stopped, kind of looked around, and then just walked away. But no shot opportunity. And that was frustrating. You know, had a great public land buck there in range.
Nice close encounter.
Couldn't make it happen. But that's how it goes. And then the salt in the wound at the end of the night was that the mature buck that I had seen walk by this spot the first night, the reason why I had moved to this new area, he goes walking by where I sat the first night at the end of the evening. So again, I'd seen two different nice shooter bucks. That was day three. Any questions on day three?
No.
All right. Day four. I appreciate you guys hearing out my whole long whitetail story. It's not nearly as adventurous as Kurt's big mountain trip, but...
No, it's action-packed.
Yeah,
it's
action-packed. It is. There's more exciting.
We're gonna
more to talk about here.
In the show notes, we're going to post all these GPS waypoints.
Oh, great. So day four, a cold front hits. So it's going from like 80 and 90. I think that day, like day three was like 90s. And now cold front was hitting overnight. It was going to drop 20 to 30 degrees. So the next day, day four, is going to be a high of... I think in the 60s. So I knew this front's passing. This is going to get the deer moving even earlier, I believed. It's been great action already, but this should ramp it up even more. Cold fronts are one of those things that more consistently than any other factor will get whitetail on their feet and moving. So,
you think it's because they get cold?
I don't think it's because they get cold. I think it's probably because there's some kind of biological drive, like you got to start packing on the food.
Yeah, just maybe, triggers
something like
triggers
that.
Triggers feeding.
Mm-hmm. So whatever it might be, I figured they'd be moving earlier. So I'd been, like I mentioned, seeing most of the activity like 5:45 to 6:45, somewhere around there. So I'd been getting into the tree at like 5. On this day, I was like, I should get in there at least an hour and a half earlier than that, just in case. So that's like 6 hours before dark. Kind of ridiculous for early season whitetail hunting. You never see that kind of activity early in the day. But it's been great. I better make sure I'm covering my butt. So sneak in there, get to that tree at 3:30 in the afternoon. I'm up in the tree at 3:35, settled. My camera's set, my bow's set. I'm comfortable. I grab a bottle of water because it's, you know, it's still a good hike in there. It was like a mile and a half hike.
Plus, hotter nuts in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Still no squirrels, though.
I can't say one way or another confidently.
I just don't, like, I would think. See, Durkin talked. At least you know what kind of tree you were sitting in. Pat Durkin talked about whitetail guys get so focused on one thing, whitetails, that they have blinders to the rest of the world. Do you feel that you're guilty of that?
I'm guilty of that to a degree. I'm aware of the things that are relevant to the hunt. Like I'm aware of the types of trees that deer like to feed on. Like I'm aware of the types of trees that they're more likely to rub on. I'm aware of the types of plant life that I'm focused on because I know that deer will be feeding on this.
So if you saw a raccoon, would you register it?
I'd probably register, yeah. I'll register most animals. But squirrels, I feel like, are just a kind of...
Kind of what?
I don't know. They're beneath my radar, I guess. Not like beneath me, but I just like... There's so many of them, usually. I can't trigger
it. Well, but you're in the transition zone. You're in the transition zone where there's not.
In this place I'm hunting, Montana.
You're just in the area where they start to... Where they... You know, they're in the major riparian corridors, nosing westward.
Okay.
It's like an incomplete map.
I guess that's true.
It's just good to know.
When I get back, I will...
Do you register cottontails?
Yeah, I see a cottontail.
You jump a cottontail, it'll click in your mind.
Yeah, I'd be like, oh, there's a rabbit.
Okay.
Yeah. Turkeys.
Register that.
Oh, for sure, I'd register a turkey.
You'd register that.
Yeah.
He'd probably just come back and say, I saw 6 mammals over 3 pounds. Under 20.
Yeah, but when you're seeing like 60 mammals over 3 pounds or over 100 pounds, the little 2-pounders just kind of hard to keep track of.
Okay. Well, I'm just requesting.
For next time.
That when doing this sort of thing, you don't need to tell me if you saw them in Michigan because they're omnipresent. But I'm just requesting that in these, just keep a mental note.
Duly noted. I will put that on the to-do list next time around.
So there you are.
Fire
nuts. Grab a sip of water.
3:35 in the afternoon. Grab a sip of water. Assuming that I'm going to have some time here to kind of just relax.
Just luxuriate.
Yeah. And while I'm in and I had lost my main Nalgene water bottle on one of these hikes back and forth. So the only water bottle I had was one of those great big steel Yeti Ramblers.
Yeah.
And so I'm in my head, I'm like, this is stupid to be bringing this out in the woods just because it's big and flashy. So in my head, I was like, well, I'll have a couple of sips right now. I'm not going to pull it out when there's going to be deer moving around or anything. But take this big swig, and mid-swig, I catch moving out of the left of my eye at 3:37. Here's this big giant buck walking right towards me.
Just out messing around.
Doing something. And it looked like, in my head, the first thing I thought, I saw the frame of those antlers, said that's that same buck from yesterday. He does not have velvet anymore. So he peeled his velvet, rubbed it all off.
Overnight.
In the moment, that's what I was thinking. In retrospect, probably wouldn't have happened that fast. But in my head, I'm like, this must be that same deer. Had the same kind of tall tines curving in, tall brow tines. And so I'm not going to let that same thing that happened yesterday happen, where I wasn't quick enough to get ready. So he's coming in. I throw the water bottle in my backpack, grab my bow, turn the camera on, spin around, get into the position. All the while, he's slowly kind of walking in. And he walks into 15 yards. I mean, I couldn't have asked for a better situation, and got a shot at him at, like, yeah, 15. And he goes running off, and I got an arrow in a public land buck just like that, 3:37 in the afternoon.
The video is funny because you could like, the camera thing is funny.
Yeah, I've zoomed way out, and the self-filming a whitetail hunt, like, that's kind of tricky.
Oh, it's a whole other deal, man.
Yeah. But I got him on foot. I got him film. Yeah. It's not, like, beautiful footage or anything, but
serves the purpose. I thought it was great.
Yeah.
I thought it was a good video. But he looks pretty far away. I was like, damn, that was a nice shot, Mark.
Definitely wasn't that far.
What do I need to do? Just go to wiredtohunt.com?
Yeah, well, I'd go to the YouTube channel maybe. Go check that out. It's on themeateater.com too. And there's a series. I did a video every day of that hunt. So each day I showcase what I was doing throughout that day. So there's 1, 2, 3, and then day 4 and 5 I put in one video at the end, because
double feature
because I shot this buck, and the shot looked pretty good. Like, in my mind's eye, looked pretty good. And I looked at the footage, because it's so zoomed out, you couldn't really tell, but it looked like it was probably the back of lungs is where I thought the shot was.
That's one nice thing about having film stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't make it worth it in and of itself, but it's a nice thing of having film stuff to analyze.
Yeah, huge. So based off that, I thought to myself, well, I'm going to give him a 45 minutes, an hour, just to be safe, and then I'll go down there and look around, check for blood, do some of that. And so that all happened, and then I got to thinking, well, I'm a mile and a half away from the truck. I don't have, like, my buck burrito. I have this, like, sled that I can use.
Yeah, what the hell is that thing? Why not just cut him up and carry him out?
I should have done that, but as a Michigan guy, like, we just don't – In retrospect, of course, you can do that, because you can do that with elk or mule deer or whatever. But in some states back east, you're not supposed to do that. So in just my head, it was like, I'm just going to drag it out like you always do.
I saw that little thing you had, that little deer dragger.
Yep. So it's just basically kind of like a plastic.
That's sold for that purpose?
Yeah. It was like $15. I was going to buy just a sled. And then when I looked for a sled on Amazon, that popped up specifically called, like, deer dragger and sled or something. I was like, oh,
yeah,
that'll
work. Get one of those otter sleds.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I decided to hike back to the truck, get that, unload all my gear that I don't need, change into some lighter weight clothes, come back in. Did all that, got back in that night, started trying to look for blood. The condensed version of this is that I could not find blood that night. Started kind of body searching into that thick stuff where I thought he must be, because I last saw him go into this Russian olive. I couldn't believe that he could go too much further, but nothing. So after dark, finally got to the point where it just seemed to be fruitless to keep on walking in there. I can't see more than 10 yards in front of me.
Were you sweating it?
I was really stressed, yeah. I was pretty upset. Because it just looked like such a slam dunk that I thought for sure that buck would be tipping over just inside the brush and he'd be right there. Because I watched him run for a couple hundred yards through this open transition. So I was shocked to see that he wasn't down so soon. Came back in the next morning, first light, and still couldn't find blood at the shot site, just a tiny little bit. And then after that, no blood trail. I went to the last spot I saw him again, and I'd watched the video, and I was like, okay, I'm pretty sure he went in front of this tree, but behind this bush. So I went to that area and then just started walking back and forth, just staring at the ground, trying to see anything. And I did end up finding blood. Now, I have a little bit of a unique situation in that I've got a little bit of red-green color blindness. So red doesn't pop as much to me as, like, my buddies. So I'll be, like, blood trailing with a friend. They're like, oh, yeah, blood, 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 blood. And I'm like, oh, yeah, oh, yeah. Like, I have to, like, get down, like, really, like, look at it. So now for me,
you need it to look like the Manson murders before you, yeah.
For it to be a really easy blood track. So I found now I look more for, like, the shape of like a blood splatter or the glimmer of like that little like fluid glare.
Yeah, the sheen.
Yeah, the sheen. And then I spot that kind of stuff and then I can see, oh yeah, that's red blood. It's a little bit more difficult for me, a little bit slower process. So maybe someone else would have spotted all this blood faster than I did. But I eventually got it and was able to follow a small blood trail of about 80 to 100 yards. And that kind of pointed me into the brush the right way. So now I had a better idea of what his trajectory was. It dried up again, though. Spent the next several hours then circling out from there, trying to find more blood or find him. And it was just that, like you said, that thick, nasty Russian olive stuff. Crawling around on all fours for most of the time to get underneath it because like just deer tunnels through there. And after 4, 5, 6 hours that morning doing that, I stumbled on him.
Lo and behold,
there he was.
Now, did it look like he had tipped over or like curled up?
He was tipped over. He wasn't curled up. But I don't know if it was a situation where he had been there for a while. I'm not sure. I don't know how long it took. But he definitely wasn't like curled up bedded. He was laying there like he just fell.
Was it a cool night?
It was a cool night, but he wasn't all like super stiff and rigor mortis like you see in many cases.
So the meat was still good?
The meat was still good. Huh. I was worried about that.
Have you tasted it yet?
No. It was a situation where it was really hot that day when I found him and I was worried about that. So I found him. By that time it was already, 11:30 or noon or something in 70s or 80s. And then, it took a very long time to get him out of there, drag him through the river, get him up those steep riverbanks. I had to develop like a pulley system with ropes to get him up and over the bank.
You need to develop a system with a knife and a backpack.
Right. Yeah. Lesson learned.
We can help you out with that.
Yeah. Great. Yeah. In retrospect, I made things much harder for myself.
Because you're not going to drive home with him whole anyway.
No. Well, the thing is, you can't drive home with him. You can't cross state lines or anything with CWD bones. And all that, too. Yeah. But got him out of there, got him cleaned up, and
what did the necropsy reveal of your shot placement?
It was back of lungs. It ended up being a slightly quartering two shot. So in retrospect, I hadn't realized that he was a little bit quartering to me. So that shot nicked the back of the lungs, liver, and then the front of the stomach. Just a little nick off the front of the stomach, and then that exit wound was plugged up with some of that stuff. And so I think that led to why he was able to go much further than I expected. Those single lung hits, at least for whitetails, are notorious for being it's a shot you think that deer would die, but many times they don't, or they go much further than you'd think. So it's kind of one of those dreaded shots that you hear about a lot.
Oh yeah. And elk on one lungs, I feel like they'll go miles.
Yeah. So I was fortunate. He didn't go too far. I found him. It was a little bit of luck and a little bit of persistence probably. And I was really, it was a great public land buck, really fun hunt. So it was great. Then headed to North Dakota.
What did you do with your deer?
So because of that warm weather, I dropped him off at the processor.
So he got it frozen?
He got frozen. I figured just get him in the fridge right away, and then I could go meet up with my friend who was across the border hunting the other spot.
We had some, with that elk I just got, it was hot. We lost a little meat, lost meat. And then I got home, and I was just like, man, I just got to dive in and eat some just to find out what I'm dealing with.
Yeah.
Because I need to set my mind at ease.
How was it?
I took a huge chunk of it and corned it. Because I wanted to be like.
Don't you feel like that's going to mask?
Well, that's the thing. So here's the thing. I'll work backward from there. So I went to an extreme. Because if it's a little bit sour, it's like you just got a tough, there's a point at which you're like, yeah, it's a little bit sour, but not enough to warrant. So anyways, I corned it. Looking phenomenal. So now, I know that that'll work, right? Like, you damn sure know that you can make, like, sausage sticks out of it. You can probably make regular sausage out of it. I know that I can corn it. And now I'll begin exploring, right, to the point where the end of the rope would be that you're cutting sashimi slices and putting, like, a little bit of coarse sea salt on it and eating it. But I started, rather than starting there and having a disappointing experience, I started at, what will I know will be good? My wife ate it. Kids all ate it. No complaints. I didn't brine it quite long enough, so it was a huge block of it. And when you got in the middle, the brine hadn't hit. A little bit brown in the middle. Had it like St. Paddy's Day. Cabbage, carrots, taters, creamed horseradish. It's so good, man.
Speaking of
kids, don't like it. So they had to fight with them about that. Like, how you do?
They don't like the corned meat.
Yeah, they just sometimes they're like a pain in the ass, man. Like boiled cabbage just somehow struck them as like, what in the world? I don't know why. Last night I fried them up fried burbot, French fries, and salad, and then I had the whole dinner. I don't need to say anything. They cleaned that whole thing out. But with making corned meat, I had to be like, dude, you're gonna have to square up. Square up in your seat and eat your food. Square up and eat your food. Square up and eat your food. Fried fish, damn. You don't say anything. Just talk to your wife. And they just sit there and eat.
This is good lessons for me to learn now.
Fried fish.
All right.
You got to train them up on it. But coming from the Midwest, like where fried fish is pretty normal. Fried fish and kids, just give yourself a break now and then. If you're the kind of like, because we're strict, man. Like we're strict. We don't let them off the hook.
As far as they're going to have to eat what you're putting in front of them.
Yeah. Like if I cook dog shit, I'm going to be like, you're going to have to eat that.
Yeah. I think that's a good way to go.
I don't know why. I don't know if it actually even helps. If you came and told me.
I think it does.
If you came and told me that it was actually detrimental and made your kids worse and less likely to be likable and less likely to be successful, I'd still make them eat it. Because it's principle. Like, it's not about, I'm not even playing long game. I'm playing short game. But I don't like to take them to someone else's house. When we go to someone else's house to eat and we're like, you know, square up, eat, that's how it's going to be. I'm not going to have them go there and have to have someone make some extra thing for them.
Yeah. Naturally, I feel like the kids, like idea of menu and the palatability of what they like to eat will naturally just narrow down if you leave them up to their own decisions.
Left to their own device.
Oh, well, yeah. For sure.
Where the reason I always are like, yeah, you're just going to eat it. Like, this is all we're having? Like, yeah, eat it, you know? And that gives them that wide range where, yeah, because we hung out with some family of mine last summer, and it was...
Careful.
It was, yeah, no, I'm just saying how it was. But there was, like, adult food, and then there was kid food.
Yeah, kids love it.
Oh, yeah.
If my kids go into a situation like that, it's like, oh, you could have these buttered noodles.
Yeah, right. My kids would eat butter noodles every day. You're right.
Yeah. Yeah, you're not there yet.
No. He's eating solid food now.
Oh, really? Still drinking mama's milk.
Still drinking mama's milk, but twice a day he's having, you know, some little veggies, or he's dabbling with real food.
I gave my kids their first chunks of venison at 9 months.
We're going to do that when I get home.
We did it where you chew it up and then give it to him like a street pigeon.
Like you actually stick your mouth down there.
No, but I would take meat, chew it all up, and then give it to them to eat. I mean, they're drinking milk out of their ma's breast.
That's true.
They can eat some meat out of their dad's mouth. Kurt, you guys got young kids. Do you guys do the like do you placate them or do you force
them? No, it's they get what we eat. And
so if you're cooking salmon or eating salmon,
yeah it's that's really all that we have is wild game salmon, and you know, that's a majority of our diet in one form or another. And my wife Nicole does a really good job of that, and the other thing we found is if you keep putting it in front of them, you know, the first couple of times I'll buck it, and you know, kind of our rule is, well, if it's a new food, you just have to try it.
We call it a plate bite.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, it's all kinds of stuff. But, you know, it's working. That's because funny. They will be picky if they want. But, you know, just the other day we took them out to sushi and total experiment. And the next thing you know, they're eating everything there.
Where'd you guys go?
Dave's.
Oh, my God.
It is awesome. Yeah. But, I mean, they're eating calamari. They're eating things that, you know, most kids don't want to stick a squid in their mouth.
Yeah.
You know, to start. But they tried it and then they dug it.
I'll give you a sack of squid. Because we're still sitting on some squid from Seattle. But I fried it for them. And they're like, that's good, right? That's squid. And then I grilled them some. And I had to defend that it was actually squid. Yeah. Like, that's not squid. Everyone knows that a squid is fried.
Yeah.
That's some other bullshit you're trying to slip past me right there.
Yeah, that's a fact.
Yeah, it's fun. I mean, it's not fun. It's aggravating. Like, it's just like aggravating at dinner. Just saying the same things over and over.
And what I don't get is there'll just be that one day when you put it on the plate and they fought it, and then it's gone. They just ate it all. just one day they decided that, okay, yeah, I'm not going to fight it. I'm just going to eat this. And
yeah, but 10,000 years ago, kids weren't asking for something else. This had what you had.
Yeah, or you went hungry.
Probably,
one of the two.
Probably not even that long ago.
I was going way, I was going to a way safe number.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You got anything you want to add, Kurt? Lots of good hunting stories, man.
Yeah, lots.
I got a follow up question on
very
your
different
hunting
stories,
because we talked a lot about gear. You know, before you went out, was there anything that you brought but you didn't use?
His gun.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I was thinking as I was hiking out.
I saw that.
I could have saved a lot of weight by just bringing some pepper spray. No, but funny enough, one of the things that I picked up after we talked about it, you guys were talking about bringing a multi-tool, like a Leatherman of some sort. I started thinking, what would I do if, you know, say a round got jammed in or, you know, a screw comes loose? And, you know, I've had other little things, but I got one of those little tiny Leatherman squirts.
Don't know that one.
Yeah, well, it's 2 ounces. And I don't know exactly how much you'd get done with it, but it's a pretty cool little tool. It has all that stuff. So, yeah, there's a few things like that that I didn't use.
We got into your head.
You did.
So you got into my head a little bit.
Yeah.
See, and then your pack came in at 27 instead of 26.
Yeah, I know. Bumped it up.
Do you bring a butt pad, like a sitting pad?
Yeah, I do. I took a Therm-a-Rest, made those old Ridgecrest or Ridge Runner, whatever. I can't remember what they were called, but it's just a real thin foam ones. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You can just cut it down. And
before they started
like
making the egg crate pattern.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't like that. These guys, like guys I work with, use the egg crate ones.
But we only run it because that's all that's available. Because, yeah, I think we'd all run smooth. And the major gripe is that
the water.
You know, if it gets wet at all, it just helps.
Like it's like the land of 10,000 lakes under your butt.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah, but I still have the old style. I got like a piece. What I originally did, at one point in time, I got where I cut off just a 3-foot chunk of my sleeping pad, thinking that my legs didn't need to be on a pad anyway. Now I'm thinking about taking a couple more inches off that and making that my sitting pad.
No, that's a good trick.
That's a napping pad.
A lot of people do that, and then to replace your pad, you just put your backpack flat down there. It's not going to pad you, but it's going to give you some separation from the cold ground.
Especially during the winter, I do that. I sit on my pack all the time. Mm-hmm. I don't even hardly pull out.
Rather than sitting in the snow and shit. Yeah.
Yeah, it gets you just that little bit of elevation. Yeah. Yeah, but I use most everything I brought, you know, other than the survival type things.
Harder than a woodpecker.
So, the follow-up question to that follow-up question is, was there anything that 4 days in you were like, oh, should have brought that. Wish I had that.
Well, that one morning I woke up and it was just socked in and it was blowing. And I started thinking, man, I wish I would have brought a book.
Mm.
If you could have brought a book, what book would you have grabbed? What do you?
Oh, man, I don't even know. I probably would have asked my wife, Nicole, what she was reading and grabbed
taking her book.
Yeah. What's good?
That's funny because I packed around I did read an article out of a magazine last week.
Yeah, I like to bring magazines because I always think in the back of my head I could burn them.
Yeah.
And the light.
Yeah, and if, you know, we're always with the crews, so you don't feel bad ripping articles out and passing them around, you know.
I might have told this story before. This is my concluding thought. We got stuck in the fog one time hunting sheep for a couple days. Did I tell this? My brother had a book.
Uh-uh.
It was the biography. How the hell did he wound up with this book? This isn't on the New York Times bestseller list. It was a really old biography of the first superintendent of Denali National Park. But he had it paperback. And we got stuck in the fog, and so he took it and cut it in thirds. Right down the spine. And he's like, well, I get the first third first because it's my book. And I want to have to read. Like, I read, like, the second third first. And then because there's three of us, switched it around. Then you got to read the middle or whatever. And then you got to read the beginning. And he got to read it in the proper order. But that got us through a couple of days of sitting in a tent.
Yeah.
Reading about that guy. The best part of that book, really the only detail of that book I remember is how vital it was for the people he hung out with to kill a bear in the fall for lard. that it was just of paramount importance to stock up on lard.
Were they black bear or grizzly? Yeah. Or
killing black bears in the fall to render out the lard for baking. Because if you didn't have lard, just was no fun. Bacon biscuits, wild fruit pie crust.
Now, not knowing, can you use the fat from sheep or anything else in the same, or is it
tallow? It doesn't have people like. Here's the thing: I was just reading this book, "Land of Feast and Famine," which is about fur trappers in the. You know, they kind of were flirting with the edge of the Arctic and the boreal forest in Northwest Territories. Point being, this is in the early 1900s. Now we look at like deer tallow, okay, like deer fat is waxy, and people trim it off because the flavor's off. It spoils in your freezer. It coats the inside of your mouth with wax. These guys would trade in. They would trade in rump fat. So when you like, if you kill a summer deer, you've seen this, Mark, no doubt, where you skin it and along the rump, you got these big flat hunks of fat. They would square those pieces up and use it as a currency. It was of such value to them to slice and eat it. And that's tallow. But like you don't, and when we were kids, me and my buddy Eddie Lulofs used to take deer fat and melt it on a burner and put it on our boots to waterproof our boots. But it doesn't smell that great. If you take bear fat, which is more like, you know, it's not waxy. So you take bear fat, mountain lion fat would work because that's not waxy at all. We were eating that, and that's pretty good. Pig fat, and that renders into a lard. You can make a similar product with deer, but it's tallow.
So have you ever tried rendering deer like we rendered the bear fat?
Me and Eddie Lulofs rendered a bunch of it. And my friend Layton.
And the product you get from that is still
it doesn't smell nice. It doesn't smell
nice.
It'll still be waxy to eat. My friend Layton did a couple of versions. He would make a boot waterproofing. He would go out and harvest his own pine pitch. He would track honeybees. He'd sit in his yard and see a honeybee and he'd watch it. You know the Tom Petty song, "I Can Track a Single Bee to Its Hive"? Layton couldn't. He would be in his yard and a honeybee would come by and he'd watch that honeybee go and he'd mark in his mind where he saw that honeybee vanish. The next day, whenever he had more time, he'd stand in that spot.
Wow.
And wait till a honeybee came by and mark where it went. And again and again and again until he was standing at the hive with his chainsaw. And he'd chainsaw the tree apart and get the beeswax out. He'd go out and harvest his own pine pitch. He would wound pine trees and get the pitch and then render down deer fat and combo them to make like a tri-blend waterproofing agent. Dude was hardcore.
That's a lot of work.
Dude was hardcore. He one time had a sheep and a bear killed a sheep and he killed the bear and fell to the hole and it ate the bear. The whole thing worked out for him. Might have been a goat. Sat his own goat carcass, mourning over his goat carcass while waiting for the bear to come back. Dude was way hardcore. He was a tree man, arborist. What was the point I was making? Point being, I don't think you would bake, and I can't say this with certainty. I don't think you would bake with deer tallow. I think that someone should try, and I might even try this year, but you can definitely bake with bear lard. And I one time rendered down fat from a buffalo, and that fat was good. And I kept some of that in a jar just to see how long it lasts. And I kept it for 5-6 years, and the color slowly changed over time. It started out pretty orange because of keratin, because it was in the summer, and their fat turns orange in the summer when they're on green grass. And over time, it turned kind of whitish and then kind of yellowish. But it was good to eat. But that fat's good to eat. It's not waxy. And it's not off-tasting. But the off-tasting is something that we've only recently decided is off-tasting because, like I said, if you read about indigenous peoples, they trafficked in it and liked it. They didn't think it was off-tasting, apparently. Yeah, that's my concluding thought. You got a concluder, Mark?
You know, I guess the only thing I would say is just... we've talked about this in the past, but one of the greatest challenges that a lot of hunters, especially east of the Mississippi, deal with is access, right?
Yes.
Finding places to hunt, and their places continue to people are losing permission. Stuff's getting leased up. It's harder and
harder
to find
place. Sold out from under them.
Yeah. And I think I just echo the fact that there are a lot of great public land opportunities for whitetail deer hunters. I think there's a misconception, and it's changing. Definitely it is changing over the last 3 to 5 years. But there's been this misconception that public land for deer hunters is lousy. And there are spots that are really challenging, no doubt about it. But you can find...
if you go down to your state game area and park in the marked parking lot,
yeah,
it might be a little chaotic.
Yeah. But you can find like really interesting, exciting opportunities that you don't need to pay a lease fee. You don't need to pay an outfitter. Especially if you go west of them, if you can take a little drive, go west of the Mississippi, these Great Plains states have tremendous whitetail hunting opportunities that are not getting tapped into yet. And it's a fun little adventure. Camp out, see some new country.
Eat hot dogs.
Eat hot dogs. Grill up a steak. Eat baked beans out of the can.
Check for squirrels.
Pay more attention to squirrels. So I would just say, you know, it's possible. It's a lot of fun. Doesn't need to cost a lot of money. Something to consider.
Janice?
And if you want to be a sheep hunter, you don't have to go to Alaska and pay $20,000 or get super lucky. You can come to Montana and just over the counter buy an unlimited sheep.
Just get
sheep
abused.
Go on a great hike.
Just get a beautiful scenic windy.
No
hike.
Need to bring a rifle, but yeah, you could be a sheep hunter for next to nothing.
A guy wrote in, he always looks at the show notes and sees that talk to, you know, it's like your name's always in there, Giannis. He was thinking it was Janice.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, man, this Janice person never says shit.
He's expecting to hear a female.
Yeah, it's like Steve and this Yanni guy.
Mm-hmm.
But then Janice must be someone like an engineer who never gets to talk.
I think I've told you this before, but one of my first jobs was answering phones for my dad when his company was just based at his house. And after school, I would just roll in and answer phones for 2 or 3 hours.
Building inspector.
Home inspector. And, I would. It was before when I was real young. Before my voice broke, nobody could tell, and so I would just roll with it. They just thought they were speaking to a young woman, I guess. Janice says, like, "Yeah, okay." Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I was young. You know, I was probably 12.
So you got good character to be able to do that.
Just run with it.
Like, you know, my wife is real mean and didn't change her name to my name. So we check into a hotel and they call up and they're like, "Hi, Mr. Finch." I'm always like, man, let me come down there, buddy.
How'd that go? Or maybe that's not a conversation for this podcast.
How'd it go? Like, why is she so mean?
No. Like, how did the decision to keep Finch versus...
Because she swindled me. She said, "Well, I don't feel like going through all the paperwork. When my passport expires, maybe I'll do it then." Passport came and went. She went out and got like a little email address that kind of throws a nod. It's horrible. I have to say, this is the thing I always bring up. Like, I say, like, people have to be like, "Oh, the Ranellos are coming over." And her too.
My wife's reasoning was she'd had that name already for nearly 30 years.
So she should have been sick of it.
Right. There you go. So she kept hers too.
Oh yeah, me and Yanni, man.
Wow, yeah.
Got no control. We got no control over our women, man.
So that's why you guys get along so well. You can kind of commiserate.
Our women just run over us, man. We got no say or nothing.
That's brutal.
You know, we just sit there and just take it.
I'm sorry.
Mrs. Canyon and Mrs. Rasco.
Yeah. Oh yeah. No questions there.
I bet these days it's 50-50.
Yeah.
I feel like I know a lot of gals that.
I'd be annoyed if my daughter took some dude's name.
Really?
Yeah. What's wrong with her name? She's got a good name. It's got a good ring to it.
Hold on. There's a name for what you just did.
Yeah. It's called hypocrisy.
Yeah, huh? Double standard.
Kurt, you got any concluders, final thoughts?
No, man. I'm doing good.
You got it all. You're spent.
Yeah.
Giannis?
No, it was really interesting.
No, that was mine. Was working off of Mark's, telling everybody they can go be a sheep hunter for next.
Oh, that's right. That was a good concluder. All right, man, guys. Next time you got a couple hunting stories, you know where to find us. Come back and join in.
Thanks.